Thank you, Charlie. Go ahead.
So let me give you a tough question. Right?
Please do.
So clearly you're a sociologist, Alfonso, because if we were to look at the economic data for market sales, so retail sales across the country, 98%.
Well, we can't, Charlie. That's the point.
Well,
we can't.
Listen, hear me out. Looking at the retail data from current sources, right, what we'd see is the malls and the fixed shop, the fixed infrastructure are accounting for a vast, vast proportion of retail sales and commercial sales. And if I'm thinking as a planner and I'm in a local community or an urban community, those are the people who are on the city council. Those are the people who economic interests, and they're investing a lot of money, both them and the owners of the infrastructure, the buildings that they're renting in or that they're owning, right? And then you have these people come in, and they don't own anything, and they just start using, right? You can see where this goes. So
right,
one
they got
big
no
issue
fixed
is,
right.
How do you address what you just said in this last closing, 60 years of an aberration, and I'm going, when I was a kid, growing up in Texas, there were no, I never saw a periodic market until I went to Europe, right? I may have had some examples that were out of Tijuana. I went to Tijuana when we were living in San Diego. So I saw some there, but I didn't even know what I was looking at because I was too young. I was just a kid, right? So you didn't know what it was, but it was different than what you had experienced. So that the successful elimination of place-based markets was not only, right, so that's a story in itself. And then how, if you're going to plan this, so the planner in me says, so there's one set of arguments, and I don't think those are, my point is your talk didn't really, those skeptics are not going to buy this.
Sure.
And on the other side, the challenge is, as planners, how do we address the reality of that 60 years, which is, by the way, the convention, and not look like it's just a bunch of sort of hippie, marginal people doing this sort of periodic kind of thing. And it's the food co-op people and the garage sale kooks, right? It's that this is a serious, right? Because you're making that case.
Right.
But I'm sitting here going, like, how am I going to make this argument as a planner in Naperville, right? Or Woodfield Mall is there, right? I mean, how do you... So I can imagine some ways to do it, but I wanted to give you an opportunity to think, how do you, and that's got to come up. You've had to experience this in your thinking.
The question is it's actually an empirical question, right? Under what conditions will storefront retail welcome sidewalk retail? And so we assume on the face of it that storefront retail will always reject sidewalk or, non-storefront retail because they have comparative advantage, right? The non-storefront people will be said to have all sorts of comparative advantages. There's different research that, so the question is under what conditions might storefront invite sidewalk? And so not Woodfield Mall, I don't think they're going to invite, but smaller malls, not regional malls. So in Madison, for instance, Hilldale Mall invited a farmer's market to set up shop there and does business there twice a week. It has for, I don't know, about 20 years now. So there's an example that on the face of it, you say, well, why did they do that, right? I mean, and the basic story behind that is that the busier a place, and this is a planner story, the busier a place, the more the possibility for all sorts of interaction, not just social, but commercial. Now, there's ways, depending upon the enterprises, the street enterprise and the storefront enterprise, for the storefront enterprise to realize more than just the chance consumption that comes from more feet on the street, right? There's research that shows in L.A. how storefront vendors do deals with street vendors for the public space in front of there. Now, of course, that is, on the other side of the scale, very small, right, and easily discounted in some regard. But between the two, right, is this sort of Hilldale phenomenon where in a district you have where when a district recognizes or wants to experiment with the possibility of increasing their supply of the retail dollar, their share of the retail dollar, by just getting more activity. So it's that Hilldale thing that I want to point to as an example. Now, let me think for just a second if there's some other examples of that I can point to. Yes, in Santa Barbara, there is a similar phenomenon. But to unpack the Madison example just a bit more, that area is becoming known in a food city. That area is becoming known as a food district because a second farmer's market opened two blocks away. That's like having, two blocks away on a state office building property. So governed by completely different regulations because state properties have one set of regulations and private property has a different set of regulations. But holding that aside, so that area is becoming known as sort of this food district where there's a Whole Foods there, there's two sort of regular grocery stores, there's these two farmers markets, there's these local restaurants that make all these claims about sourcing from particular vendors in these markets or using, so they're my response, I guess, then in short would be, despite the comparative advantage that stores perceive vendors to have, they can take advantage in some regards of that comparative advantage through a variety of partnership strategies, that one of which might be to actually serve as rents, but another to supply food to different places. And those things are going to move very slowly, very gradually. And eventually they will get to some asymptote, right? But the middle part of that curve, we haven't begun to explore completely yet. And I think that there's a lot of opportunity. So this grant that Rachel mentioned, I'm one of the people, I'm sort of the markets guy. I'm sort of the guy, markets now in the abstract, right? Trying to understand not just physical location, but also, other business aspects associated with local and regional food. This will be very interesting to try and understand the scalability of the variety of models and how scalable they may be. Sorry, that's kind of a long answer, but did you sort of do justice? You want to tag back on? Because I like...
No, I just wanted to get things going.
You bet. Yeah, Dave.
So I guess I have another tough question, which is you talked a lot about the kind of the good things of markets, and actually there's this farmer's market in Evanston that used to be beautiful. We love to go up there. It's like kind of entertainment. So I'm sympathetic to all that, but I want to tell you a little story since you like stories. So there's been a rash of bike thefts here at UIC, and I recently had my bike stolen, and after I had my bike stolen, I had some communication, and I was informed that probably what happened is that the people that stole the bike were going to sell it at this market, this open-air market, right? And I guess the idea is that pawn shops are regulated, so you can no longer take them to pawn shops and sell them. So you take them to these open-air markets. So here's my question. The question is, right, we want to keep the spontaneity in markets, this diversity in markets, but on the other hand, we don't want people providing a place for other people to sell stolen bikes, stuff like that, right? So how do you draw the balance? Like, how much regulation of the market do you do so that you kill the stolen bikes, but you don't kill the...
Right. This is a really hard question, right? Because that question of regulation cuts across it cuts across behavior in public place, right? It cuts across a whole host of similar questions. And this is, whenever I was a vendor, I was a street vendor for almost 2 years in Maxwell Street before, in the late 1980s, early 1990s. And there was stolen goods fenced in Maxwell Street, no question about it. There was fewer than people probably thought, at least in my sample of 56 households. I work with 56 households at the market, and a few of them sold stolen bikes. Now, the city at the time had a real hands-off, sort of hoping for it to implode, hoping for the market to sort of implode. It never did, and so they didn't step in and regulate it very much. And the vendors themselves, even though they knew that sometimes their neighbors were selling stolen goods, even though they knew it, everybody sort of said, okay, they had other fish to fry. They wanted to help each other protect their space. And as long as I had a good neighbor protecting my space, I'm not going to worry too much about where those trunk loads of tools come from at 3:30 in the morning every Sunday morning. Okay, I mean, you could be there and watch this right now. So one part of my answer is that the degree of commerce represented by stolen goods is maybe less than what we fear, and our personal experience of it magnifies its impact. Okay, I think that's something that statisticians warn us about all the time. But on the other hand, it's clearly important for jurisdictions to try and get a hold of and steer people from, through the various ways that they have possible, steer people from illegal, patently illegal things to more legitimate things. Now, I'm not sure how I could get the guy that I knew, let's just call him Ace, from selling stolen bikes in Maxwell Street, because with the proceeds from that, he bought 27 buildings in the city of Chicago over the course of 15 years, okay? And had a whole host of things, and consciously rented, to low income and kept up his buildings and took great pride in his buildings, the basements of which housed stolen goods that he sold on Maxwell Street. Okay? I wish he was here, and if you'd ever been down to Maxwell Street, I bet you'd recognize him if I brought him in here, okay? I'm not sure how, because what he saw, he said, I know where this is coming from. Okay? But I also know what it is producing. And so that's a difficult sort of Robin Hood mentality that I'm not sure, how to think about it. Now, so I think that, and since then, in the early 2000s, he actually had legal problems and spent 6 months, I think, in Cook County, had some different things happen to him. But there's a variety of folks, it seems to me, who aren't in that, but using our various regulatory and incentive devices, right, we can help them graduate, you might say, from some activities that they're part of into other activities. And yes, it's true that presumably the big investments that are made produce a higher cost-benefit ratio than these smaller investments. However, that really is an assumption that begs empirical analysis, especially empirical analysis not just of the immediate returns on investment, but the longer-term investments that people make in human or other physical capital over the longer term through these businesses and their families and other that create returns that you don't necessarily see in big physical infrastructure. I mean, the way those get accounted for seem to me to be there'll be different things, and I think that we can incentivize those through various permitting and licensure and other regulatory infrastructure that we're not taking advantage of. We're not thinking about how to do how to use the power of local regulations to benefit these other people. We focus entirely on the sort of the large scale and don't think through these other things. Paper talks about this some. I'm sorry I'm not talking about it real super clearly, but I hope you get the gist. What do you think? Dave, Matt, you want a time? Tell me, Matt, you feeling bad still, Dave? I'll give you a hug after the talk. Right?
I think it's a hard problem.
It's a hard problem. On the one hand, you definitely have to, inhibit or stop insofar you can things that are patently illegal. But what about panhandling, right? There's a whole host of people in this thing that's called the right to the city, right, that says, we should permit, all this variety of behavior. And there's a lot of people who say, as soon as you do that, this is sanitized now. My friend was commenting on how the Marrakech market has become a sanitized figment of its former self in favor of tourism. Hard to know how this happens. But, of course, retail comes in all sorts of flavors, right? Primary retail. How many of you shop at Miracle, Michigan all the time, right? No, you know, you're like me. You go to McFrugal's, you go to Rust, Rust for Less, right? You know, you get your cousin to make your jewelry for you, you know? So, I don't know. Okay. Yes, miss.
Okay, so my question is actually about the relations between marketplace and state. Because, you know, based on my own observation, it seems, you know, many marketplaces, you know, in different cities, actually they emerge at edge of the urban space, or actually they emerge when the state control is really weak, so that the vendors or the business owners, they can, you know, they can maybe run away from the fees, charges, or different types of regulations. And oftentimes, those kind of informal markets are really vibrant, you know, compared with markets that were set up by the nation states. So actually, to me, the marketplace, in some places, actually, they become the stage where you see there's the competition between the state regulation and the social forces. Or, to use some other terms, maybe it becomes a contested space or sort of informal economy is going on there. Even though there are markets which were set up by the state at the very beginning, sometimes they grow, they would outgrow themselves. So like the central market, in Paris, they are. So that is why it was demolished by the nation state in the 60s and the 70s. So I guess my question is, you didn't really touch upon this kind of the political struggle within the marketplace.
Right.
So you make some comments about
two, that. Yeah, two things. Just two things I can say. Let me do a quick parenthetical on this notion of informal. This notion of informal and formal represents something called a dualism that I don't like. I think dualisms are lousy ways to learn about anything. I think that this is what we call formal and informal. As long as we think about it in real sort of simple descriptive terms, it's okay. The absence of regulation or something like that. A lot of times people reify those terms. And conceptual dualisms, you can learn a whole lot more about them from reading Charlie's work or going back to Mead and Dewey and the American Pragmatists or before them to philosophical lineage, but that's interesting. I think, and I've written about why those dualisms are not effective ways to theorize in the sense of explain or understand people's behavior. Now, in terms of the regulation in the contested space, I think the fundamental problem for planners is how to turn the contested space into the progressive partnership opportunity. A lot of times, right? It's pretty simple, right? It's pretty simple. These things are social constructions, right? There's a regulation that says vending's illegal. Okay, let's capture some of the revenue from the vendors and make it legal. Let's turn our enemies into partners in some regards. And some of those enemies will not want to become partners because they're selling stolen goods or they're doing other sorts of things. Well, okay, let's try and figure out, let's learn about their supply chain. Let's go to them sort of in anticipation of generative partnerships rather than in anticipation of conflict. And so now that's a real rosy picture and sort of a, but it's not tried very often either. And I think that when people try it, you know, Austin is a good example of this. Street markets in Austin, Texas, until the 1970s, street vendors really were these hippies, right? They still are hippies, but they were not only hippies, they were like non-grata hippies. I mean, nobody wanted them around. And in the 70s, in the early 80s, the city started saying, wow, you know what? This is what's keeping Austin weird, or what became Austin weird. Monitor, right? This is part of what's making this a destination place that's attractive to what we call now the creative class, right, or other sorts of people like that. So what they said is, okay, we're going to try two different things here. We want to partner with you, but we'd like to see if you're willing to restrict yourselves in particular ways, not only to particular places, but to particular times in other places. And let's see how this works out. And so what they did was really smart. They proceeded in a way that sought, you know, to give some ground and to expect the other parties to give some ground. But they also proceeded experimentally. They said, let's see what happens. You know, we're not going to make this ordinance set in stone. We're going to find out what happens, and we'll adjust it as time goes on. And I think that that's something that planners and policymakers need to do is think in terms of experimental approaches to these things that we're rediscovering, that were once really important, that are very important, contingent on your socio-demographic or socio-economic status, although they may be illegal, they're really important, and can be harnessed to other larger state goals if they kind of come under, or if they sort of work together to create an experimental atmosphere that fosters these multiple objectives. Make sense? You know, I mean, I can appreciate it. I mean, I was an illegal vendor for months in Madison Street. Then I discovered you needed a license. Nobody told me you needed a license. This was a time when the market was basically regulating itself, had basically was self-organized. And whenever I found out about it, I wish I'd have brought my licenses. One of them I'm smiling, the other one I look like a vendor. You know, and but lots of people prided themselves on, yeah, I got a license, it's 9 years old. I only pull it out, you know, the cops come by maybe once every 6 months. And everybody's just thumbing their nose at each other. That is not an atmosphere that is conducive to achieving collective goals, right? If we say, you know what you guys are doing is important, it's important to you, but it could have these other important elements to that. Have you ever thought about it? It's sort of the Smithian, you know, it's really the Smithian, you know, moral sentiments cobbled really together. The division, right? The division says we can realize these benefits of division of labor, and the theory of moral sentiment says, well, those benefits are really most notable when they're anchored to a collective, to the collective activities of the population.
Cool.
Rachel?
I'm just wondering, part of that experimentation revolves around issues of land tenure. I'm thinking that a lot of the benefits of marketplaces as a planning strategy are its sort of spatial informality, its flexibility, its ability to sort of quickly be developed, or not quite developed, or, you know, useful in a particular location, and how you don't need to actually own the land, and there can be all these sort of arrangements that will allow you to sort of live on the surface of that. But those are also the same characteristics that lead to their easy dismantling. And what I've seen over my few decades on Earth are these markets being dismantled, that they're sort of become, you know, sort of pop-up uses, temporary uses, holding patterns for land, for the sort of primary market of capitalist land development. And that issue of sort of uncertainty is, I'm sure, one that, you know, it's something that vendors have to live with, and they're sort of used to that, that they could be closed down at any moment, so that they're, you know, the state is kicking them off that land because they found a developer who's interested in buying the property. And, I mean, it also, you know, it's happened where I grew up, where they took... this is a big market, big, you know, marketed in Long Island and turned it into the Belmont Racetrack. Well, that was probably 30 years ago. My uncle used to sell tube socks there, and it was, you know, your sort of classic gain a foothold in the American dream, all the kind, you know, sort of opportunities for immigrant entrepreneurship. But as soon as there was a land deal that looked attractive to the local state and to a big developer of entertainment complexes, it became a... it's gone, just like, you know, and we've got Maxwell Street Market here, and I'm sure there are millions of cases. So I'm just wondering, you know, what sorts of land tenure strategies can be experimented with so that this phenomenon we're seeing, the sort of renaissance of markets, isn't just a sort of pop-up blip, but it's something that's a little bit more durable and long-lived.
Yeah, I think the New York Green Market System, which you're familiar with, I'm sure, is a real good example of a land use strategy that's flexible in this regard. The notion being that if you have a system of something, when one element of the system suffers, the entire system isn't jeopardized. And that element can be given opportunities to sort of flourish either elsewhere or as part of something else while a new space is set up. So markets in the singular can have a bunch of trouble. And that's the way markets were founded 100 years ago, right? The last big census of marketplaces in the U.S. was 1920. Wow. There were 237 markets in cities with a population of 30,000 or more. And there were, I think at that time, there was 100 cities with a population of 30,000 or more. There were 237 public markets. But they were all individual creations. It may have been Fulton Fish Market, or it may have been, the Reading Terminal in Philadelphia. It may have had a real clear place identity, but still it was a single thing. So I think one of the things is for cities to sort of think kind of big, scale kind of big, and say all those informal markets that pepper a place, let's turn them into a system of markets that we think of as playing an important role in the larger social, political, economic life of our metropolitan area, and this is how, and so literally kind of go through step at a time. Now, since I'm not a planner by training and don't have a host of experience in this regard, I don't know how naive that just sounded, but one way to experiment in this regard is to literally plan a number of markets to go into place simultaneously. Sort of like the way the city of Chicago. When the city of Chicago started its farmers markets thing, they didn't start with just one. Mm-hmm. They put six or eight, all opened the same time. They said, if we're investing in one, it's just as easy to figure out what to do about eight. And now, how many are there? There's 27, I think, in the city of Chicago, or 22 farmers markets. So other land use strategies, I think the example of Ann Arbor is sort of useful. Other jurisdictions have done the same thing, where they sort of anchor a market to the prospects, other economic investments in a place, or the prospects of regional tying together what makes the market work, or part of what makes the market work in terms of local crafts or local food or whatever it happens to be, tying those things together so that people are more invested in the market. But having said that, this is really what plagues like urban agriculture, right? I mean, urban agriculture felt this all in one five-year chunk of time when 5 years ago, oh, yeah, we'll just grow all this food in these vast swaths of Detroit. Now, it's like, oh, this guy's buying all this land. Now he's going to turn it into, he's just going to hold it temporarily and let people grow food on it until the value goes up a little bit. Then he's going to wipe it all out and turn it into billions of dollars. That was just a story maybe some people read about in the New York Times magazine the last few weeks.
Are there cases, though, where, collectives or cooperatives of vendors have actually ended up purchasing the land? And
the Santa Fe Indian Market? Not the Indian Market, the Farmers Market. The Santa Fe International Farmers and Crafts Market, I think, is the official name. Mm-hmm. So the classic Santa Fe market is around the plaza, mm-hmm. right? That's a private entity. It's like, that's a public, that's a state government situation. But the International Food and Craft Market, that they purchased it. Let me think about if there's other examples off the top of my head. This is one of the interesting things. I've been collecting this data and offering advice occasionally on a markets listserv. And I think it's really interesting to see the variety of questions that come up about these sort of land use. And so it'd be an interesting article to write. I wanted to do that, actually. Yes?
From your research in the market so far, and looking at the different design formats for markets and different ways that markets are trying to defend an urban environment or on the outskirts of an urban environment, what would you find to be some of the more successful ways that market spaces are used outside of the time that they're outside of the once a week or a couple hours a week that they're used as a market. Some of the examples I gave were oftentimes enclosed areas that had a roof and that had walls. Maslow Street Market is a public right-of-way. At least it used to be. I don't know where it is now. But and versus, say, 3 or 4 blocks in the middle of, a residential neighborhood that are devoted to a parking lot or that have 40 U-Haul trucks which come in a couple times a week.
Right.
What have been...
Or a racetrack. A horse racetrack is another example that comes to my mind. Or the Tanquevedo swap meet in Tucson. I mean, part of this has to do with sort of the land rent, the land rent curve, right? How valuable the land is. And so in the case where there's little value associated with the land, sometimes that's the only use, is that it's a periodic once-a-week market or something like that. Where it's a very dense neighborhood and there's a lot of activities, the market is in some respects ancillary to the other uses, right? So it sort of flips it on its head. I think that the fundamental takeaway to this question is that the more uses that you find in a place, the livelier or more vibrant that whole place is, and the more economically, politically, socially active it is. Right. So this isn't to say that people at a racetrack in Calexico, California, that get together once a week in this now abandoned racetrack, horse racetrack, don't have a great time there once a week. They do, and that the amount of money that those people make is unconscionable. Renting to the vendors, it's a crazy amount of money, cash income untaxed. I mean, but in a dense, in urban environments, I think markets, street vendors, are just one among many complementary uses. The thing is looking for the partnerships and the regulatory apparatus to ensure that complementarity is really generative of a variety of benefits and doesn't limit, hobble any particular use. Let me let you tag back and then I'll come to try. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I guess just on an urban design perspective, what are the more successful ways that people have used the space that where a market exists? If you were to place it in the context of an urban neighborhood or an urban commercial district, what else could that space be used for? So that's not just an empty building, that's not just an empty lot in the middle of a commercial district.
Yeah, I don't have one particular one. Let me tell you, this is my next book project. I'm going to apply next year for a Baldwin Idea Grant at the UW to do what this is something completely new to me, too, an architectural pattern book for markets. Now, I don't know if you all know what an architectural pattern book is. I didn't know until a couple years ago. What they are is, back 100 years ago, architects... created books of facades of the process of creating a neighborhood and with particular attention to the design elements, to the physical design elements. And I see this as a pattern book that's attentive not just to physical design but to the social and political economic roles. And so to actually go to a bunch of different markets around the country and see, have a sense of the history, but understand how they work in their space, from the various elements. So I hope nobody writes that book before me. But anyways, because I think it's a good book. I think
it's a book that's Grid and City or City and Grid that just came out, Planner's Press. It shows markets, but not the kind you're talking about. It's
City Grid.
It's an upscale... markets in cities across the country. If you go to Planner's Books, I can't think of the authors, but they're
City and Grid.
City and Grid.
All right, here, just a second. Ta-da! have my new...
But it's not what you're proposing. But it's a good example. A lot of relief maps, all to scale.
Well, that's cool. So
it's
this
a really
is,
cool visual...
I never thought...
Form and design scale type market. But are you ready for me to ask the next question?
Yes, sir. Please, fire away.
The question that's related to this, but it's the dynamic side. So let's think about how do these markets work? And there's multiple purposes you gave us at the beginning, but I want to focus on one dimension, some of the contradictions or tensions within it. So one idea is we have the market, it's the single person got an idea, has a, you know, either scout, you know, has a supply, shows up, and with very low cost can get into play. They can enter the market. So one concept we have is that the whole modern industrial period, that 60 years you're talking about, or let's say 150 years, and then the city form that came with it, is we used to have lots of periodic markets, right? In fact, that's how most of the markets were. And part of the story of cities is that markets have a place, right? It's only recently then that they've become stores and malls and decentralized because of the structure of modern transportation. So most of human history, most markets were periodic and so forth. I'm sure you're familiar with this. So the question then, so that's one story, right? That's, what do we need to learn from that story about place? Now that we realize there's something, we went too far, right? That's part of the tale you're telling. So we want to go back, but we don't want to go back to periodic. But we're not going to get rid of the mall, right? But the mall's going to become something else. So that's one set of things. But what I wanted to think about out loud with you, because it's not something I thought a lot about, but you have this threshold problem. Because land rents are high, and because the thresholds of regulation, this is where the neoconservatives, neoliberals, we are our own worst enemies. I wish Bob were here, because this is for Bob Rubin. This is his area. This is his turf. So you'd say there are these impediments for people entering in because the standards, the regulations, the license fees, the whatever the fees are, keep out people who would show up, legitimate people. Okay, we're not talking about the ones who are, you know, robustly considered. So they can't get in. So one of the ideas of a market like this is to and you were telling the story that way. We look the other way, we don't impose the rules. So there's a variety of ways to not make people pay the penalty of the full cost of regulation. And partly that's because the regulations aren't elastic enough, right? They are threshold driven. And even think of the housing market the same way. Why don't we have housing units that only have 50 square feet? Right? And then we have most homeless people can afford rent. We don't allow them. Right? So, and we don't allow them to build their own houses in the United States. That's how most people are, you know, for this. Right? So we don't, so you could do the same analogy with housing. So that the conservatives gave us an argument many years ago, they said, let's have enterprise zones. And these will be little zones, locations, think market, location. We'll go in and we'll suspend the conventional rules. We'll create a special pocket of rule-free, think trade-free zone, right? The rules won't apply, and this will become an incubator for this. So now you take that idea and you link it up with these businesses are growing. So one thing is the business is going to grow. You're the small guy. Then you grow, you incubate, then you move into storefront. That's one model. But wait, that's not the Paris market. People go to the flower. That flower vendor's been coming there for 20 years, right? Week after week, we build this relationship, and I love selling my flowers. So I'm making a good living as a flower vendor in the Paris market, because I'm right there at the peak land rent, and everybody's going there. So you get these different ideas about the market. And I'm just alerting you to this because it's at one moment I'm hearing the story of the small, rugged individual, and if we could just get rid of the impediments, they would. Then I'm listening, I'm thinking when I was in Paris, those people were not poor, and boy, they had really good flowers, and then you could get the croissant across, right? Right? You have all of that, and it's really a high rent location, and it's got all that intersection of, you know, right now we're on the Miracle Mile, it was the old upside down skyscraper, you know, with the mall in it. And there are different ways that the modern replace that, right? It's competing for the same space. So now, how do we compete with that same space? Because that space has been compromised or it's been consolidated, however you want to do it. And we don't get the Parisian experience. I didn't have the Parisian experience. You know, we were high school. We were kids. We didn't have any place to go. We went to the mall, right? And the mall is like, but if you go to the Paris market, there was a place for you, right? We're figuring this out. So I'm sharing it with you to see, as you're thinking about this and working it out, because you did the list, but you didn't say, this is the kind, and then this is going to go here, this is the incubation threshold. But that's what I'm trying to figure out, because as a planner, say should we get rid of the regulations, or are we going to attract the bad guys? Then we have to have a policing structure. Well, yeah, if you have an informal policing structure, but that doesn't come, that takes decades to build, right? That social capital isn't instantaneously available. And in the old markets, it's generations, right? So you're talking years, maybe 10 decades, or 10 centuries, right? 10 decades. So right? That's a sunk cost that's not easy to, that makes that place extraordinary. So I'm really excited by what you're doing, but I see all these problems of the regulation issue. It's really a big problem. And then the spatial issue. Why do we need space? You got eBay. So how do you articulate? Because we all know we want that place experience. If you've had it, you want it again. But then, it's Amazon is so quick. Why do I have to go to the bookstore? Right? I can do it on eBay. Why do I? So what is it that you're going to teach us about how that would work? So planners, because they're facing both of these things. They're going to have people on the, they're going to have the store owners on the village commission saying, this is our bread and butter. You bring those people in, my sales are, they're not convinced that that's going to be a zero, not a zero-sum game. It's going to be a win-win, right? It's going to, and it won't be for any one industry, right? Some people are going to lose. Because they're going to go to this. The people who makes the crappy bread is going to lose out to the vendor who's making it fresh every day. And so that's a challenge. How do you... So I'm excited by this, but I'm raising these questions that as a planner, I don't know the answer to.
I can dig it.
You can get them all answered in the next couple of minutes. So.
Absolutely.
No, they're really to... not meant for you to answer. They're just observational. This is a really exciting idea. And, I came at this from the housing business, dealing with homeless people. And years ago, I got in the office and said, we need more hotels that are really cheap rent and not very nice. And people don't want to build them.
So let me see, Charlie, you got 2 hours? No. No, I'm serious. I think I got some answers to some of this because I think it's interesting. One, some people always lose, right? Risks don't pay off, right? We roll the dice and bad things happen sometimes. I think that what's really important about what you said are the institutional rules of the game that in which people are rolling the dice, because some people are rolling loaded dice contingent on those rules, right? We know that some people's dice are loaded, right? So the empowerment zone, I think, is interesting. I think a fascinating research project for somebody would be to go out and look at all the empowerment zones, how many still exist, and the different means, how those have been transformed in their particular places to fulfill their original mandate. I only know a few idiosyncratic examples, but some of them have transmortified into permanent jobs for their original executive directors. Okay? The analog, then, for markets are those, how it is that they become, how it is that jurisdictions help establish rules of the game create that not incentivize, not create, that are generative of ways to fill the niches. Because the big story, as you know, is overgrazing story, right? And they've been overgrazed by the big storefront and the big mall, and all the other niches have gone away, right? So, but those niches were still there. They were just scurrying little mice in the corners for 50 years. Now they're coming back, and with a vengeance. The hippies brought them back. The local wars brought them back. The arts and crafts people brought them back. If you look around, you find these big newsprint catalogs of arts and crafts fairs, of swap meets for the Midwest, directories, and people follow seasonally these markets from place to place. And so... what they're doing is they're cobbling together a living from the variety of sort of idiosyncratic reasons that markets exist in different places. Now, to bring some reason to that, to bring some system, not reason, to bring some system to that, jurisdiction should, it seems to me, an opportunity for planners to think about how can we impose some system of not just land use strategies, but economic development opportunities that harness to capital for those who want to grow, and that enhance program participation, job training, human capital, that then that become avenues for people to repopulate the various economic niches. This basically means returning markets and vendors to the legitimate status that they enjoyed traditionally. It isn't a radical, it feels like a radical reconceptualization because an entire generation passed without them, right? So it feels like it, but a historical eye with a view to the variety of intersections sees it as an opportunity. So that's sort of the analog. The empowerment zone, I would suspect, I'm not going to do this work, somebody should though, if it hasn't been done, that empowerment zones are trying to fulfill their mandates in a variety of ways, with the dice loaded in different ways for different purposes in those jurisdictions. I think there's an analog here. The point you make about inelastic regulations, downward inelasticities of regulatory power, I think that's a really interesting, I mean, you're right, and it is a dance that I'm doing, because because whenever I was in Maxwell Street, I bought a bike that was probably stolen from somebody before I started vending and doing my research. I said, man, and that was part of the impulse. Somebody said, where'd you get that bike? I got it in Maxwell Street. Well, at the time, you all know that, I mean, Maxwell Street had different names, right? And so when I was in school at UFC at the time, and some of the black people I hung out with, everybody called Maxwell Street Jewtown, right? That's what black people call Maxwell Street, it's Jewtown. So I got a Jewtown. Oh, man, you know that somebody got rolled for that bike. I remember this conversation. I said, being kind of, not entirely naive, but being kind of naive. I mean, I was raised in a farm in New Mexico. I mean, I thought, you know, if somebody says I got a bike, I thought it was associated. I didn't inquire a lot about it. And I said, just a second, you think somebody? And that was one of the things that started me thinking about, wow, what an interesting place. Why didn't the cops bust this guy? Why, you know? So I'm sympathetic to that side of it. And, you know, I think about my friend Nam Chandler, who I had the conversation with so many years ago. And I wonder, you know, I wonder about, you know, flexible regulatory processes. I wonder, you know, the different thresholds that trigger new regulatory mechanisms, right? So the one that I commonly trot out about vending licenses is, why not let all kinds of people vend in a place? Garage sale guys and everything, and then their continued presence for X amount of weeks triggers something, right? Or their presence in X weeks out of 52 triggers a regulatory thing. And then in terms of this notion that there'll be, I think the social space is uneven in how retail will push back. Because in the last 2 months, I can give you emails from planners in Maine and in Oregon who emailed me and said, we want more street commerce. The storefront businesses want more street commerce. How do we do it? How do we tell our city people? So I would point you to zoning for markets and street vendors in the journal Zoning Practice. And zoning for urban agriculture, both of which I co-authored, right? Talking about, you know, regulatory devices in this regard. So there's not uniformity, I guess. And then I really do think, and this is something that Rachel and I talked about some before lunch, too. We had this really great conversation because she's working on eBay, as you all know. And And
she can't hold a regular job.
It's my other source of income.
That's right. You know, I mean, the state, you know your state's having financial difficulties.
I'm not selling on it. I'm just studying.
Your senior faculty are rolling people for used bikes.
Yeah.
So, Dave, you didn't have to go so far for your bike.
I have
man.
A bike. I just sold it to somebody in Maine.
That's right.
So, Alfonso, we should probably wrap up because we said it. So, I want to just take this opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Richard, very much for being here. Thank you all for your questions.
Thanks for coming.
You betcha. It was my pleasure. Really.